attitude. We are going to energise the country.
Stop Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus, I'm not sure this is a great idea either.
Order!
Hello and welcome to Debated Podcast. I'm Conrad. I'm joined as usual by Will. And today, our guest is Hannah Shah, who is the co-host of the Progressive Britain podcast, which is the Progress podcast, the Labour-affiliated group. I don't know if it's officially affiliated, but associated with Labour. Thanks for joining us, by the way. Before we get into the main sort of meat of the podcast, what made you get involved with Progress originally?
That's a really interesting question. I think it's kind of weird because if I were to characterise us as a group, yes, we're a Labour-affiliated group, we're a campaigning organisation, but actually, if you're a politico or you like politics, you'd probably classify us as a faction, which all sounds a bit Renaissance and Machiavellian Game of Thrones, right? And so it seems quite an odd thing for someone to do, particularly someone to do as a job. But I spent a lot of my time, and where I come from, my like personal background, insofar as you can say that someone in their 20s has a background, it's very much in charity campaigning. So I'm a trustee of a charity that I got involved with when I was about 17, raising money for street children around the world. And then when I went to university, I did lots of work on educational access, particularly around the access to higher education that refugees have. And sort of have been interested more broadly in this question of how young people make social change. And I've always been a Labour voter, but I wasn't a Labour member until a little bit later than lots of my colleagues and friends in the party. I actually joined after Jeremy Corbyn became leader, and actually partly as a reaction, because I grew up personally in a household that wasn't very well off. My mum was disabled and wasn't able to work. My dad doesn't have a degree and came here as a migrant, so he worked in a factory when I was younger. So I very much see the sort of practical impact that Labour politics and sort of progressive politics has had on my life. And it was sort of in defence of that politics that I ended up where I am now, which is sort of trying to fight for progressive values within the Labour Party.
Now, one of the campaigns that you are involved with is Labour Say. Now, at the moment, we're having quite an interesting development regarding Brexit, with the case going through the Supreme Court at the moment and the appeal in the Scottish Courts as well. What do you think the general feeling regarding another referendum or some sort of like resolution to Brexit is at the moment?
I think that's a really difficult question. I think when you talk about the feeling regarding a referendum, it really depends on who you're talking to, right? So with my hat on as working at Progress, I know about 80% of the Labour membership is pro-Remain. But you also know that the Labour leadership has done a sort of interesting job at triangulation on the issue over the past couple of years, because the Labour Party knows that lots of its key seats are in Leave areas. And what I've seen from being around the media, and I occasionally, for my sins, do talk radio with Julia Hartley Brewer. And she is sort of a rabid Brexiteer. Sorry, Julia, if you're listening. But she sort of epitomises what I think is the polarisation of the conversation that's happened since the referendum. I think there is a way forward, and I actually think there's a way forward democratically that now can only come from a public vote on a deal, not just because I think that's a good way to sort of constitutionally and politically achieve a Remain result, although that is my personal preference, but more because I think it's gotten so confused and people have received so much conflicting information that actually when you come to the end of this process, it becomes very difficult to feel like people have control of their own destinies and over the future of their own country, which is actually what I think this whole vote was about. People feeling that they have control over their lives, and why they don't or do feel that they have that control. Actually, until you have that opportunity to make a choice at the end point, Do I think Remain would win again? I'm not actually sure, but I think that it's an important exercise to have nonetheless. But I mean, it's a very long-winded way of saying I don't know.
The thing is, with sort of another referendum, could you not argue that that could just divide the country even more and just bring up, like, you've already got this sort of, you've mentioned the polarisation in the country, sort of two halves, and another referendum could just sort of polarise that even more, and especially if the question was not seen to be one that was fair. You mentioned having a vote on the deal, but obviously there's a lot of people seem to want no deal. If that wasn't an option on the referendum, if it wasn't like three choices, then they could feel disenfranchised.
Absolutely. I think that is a conversation for further down the line, right? I think seeing and making sure that people perceive fairness through every part of this conversation is really important. I think a way to potentially think about that or make a choice on what the referendum should look like on the next stage of the democratic process might be using a citizens assembly. They did that quite successfully in Ireland with abortion, which was a very contentious issue. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting, this conversation about polarization. Without wishing to get all identity politics, I think, like, I'm a woman, I'm a British Pakistani, and like those bits are parts of my identity, but I don't tend to sort of throw them out there very much, like they're not core parts of my politics, which are based around social justice. But actually, it informs me, and when I respond to when people say, oh, will you see more polarisation, I'll say, actually, if you're a minority, particularly if you're a visible minority in this country, you've seen that polarisation already, right? I don't think it can get much worse in terms of yes, you could get writing tweets, etc. But actually, the effects of the Brexit vote are already being felt really acutely. And I don't think just by not having another vote and sweeping it under the carpet that we'll be able to solve these problems. Like, we won't be able to solve the problem of Tell Mama reporting spikes in Islamophobic incidents. We won't be able to make, you know, migrants, like, I come back talking about my parents. Like, my parents have lived to remain in this country. They never applied for British passports because they never thought they needed to. And in their minds, they're Commonwealth citizens who have come to this country to work hard and raise a family, and they feel that they have some kind of historic contract, I think, with the British state. But actually, for the first time in my life within the past couple of months, my dad has sounded unsure and felt insecure in this country. And I think that hints at a polarisation that I think will exist whether or not we have another vote, and we need to tackle that separately.
Now, one of the parties that have done quite well out of polarisation has been the Liberal Democrats, and their conference is happening at the moment. How do you think members of the Labour Party who are in favour of a second referendum and who want to remain in the European Union can appeal to potential swing voters who might see the Liberal Democrats more as the party of Remain?
I think that's a very good point, and I can see why there are people I know who have been in the Labour Party for a long time or a short time who've chosen to either leave the Liberal Democrats as members, or actually on a personal level, lots of my personal friends who aren't very sort of political, i.e. they're not card-carrying party members. I mean, we need to remember not many people in this country are card-carrying party members, but who have historically always been Labour Party voters, and who for the first time have actually broken that tradition of voting Labour. I mean, the first time would have been during the European elections, to vote Lib Dem. And are now talking to me when I say the general election coming, are actually saying we want to vote Lib Dem because we see them as a party representing our interests and representing the kind of Britain we want to see. And I do think part of it is getting off the fence on Brexit, but I think it's also part of it is the Labour Party thinking about not only how we create a fair and socially just society, but also thinking about how we bring people in to do that. I think the perfect example, and sort of the little bit of Blairite in me will come out now, is the national minimum wage. And it's to make that change, and you can say what you like about how, whether it's been increasing up over the past few years, but the success of the national minimum wage, and I think, and the reason why it's become such a structurally integral part of our labour market is because it was done not only with the consent of the voters and the politicians, but it was also done with the consent of industry as well. Mm. And actually, when you're thinking about making structural social change, and I think that's something I believe in, that the Labour Party believes in too, you have to gain consent from people to do that, and you have to make the effort to persuade people around to your point of view. And unfortunately, I think that while we have some brilliant policies, that actually the work isn't being done to actively go out and persuade people as to why these policies are a good thing or why they're important. And I think it's sort of reaching out and removing some of this negative things. Oh, well, if you don't agree with every part of my plan, you should just, you know, piss off and join the Tories because you're clearly a Tory, is quite unhelpful and quite juvenile. And actually what it does is alienate people from a project that should be working together for everyone.
So we're talking about the Liberal Democrats, and we've had recently, you've had Chukwuemeka and Angela Smith, former Labour MPs, join the Lib Dems. Do you think that there's a worry that they're sort of the Blairite progress, sort of whatever you want to call it, wing of the party might sort of feel like there's no place left for them in Labour, with the sort of rise of things like mandatory selection being tried to bring in and stuff like that, that the party is going to become more narrow and sort of Corbynite in its focus?
So I guess there is definitely a feeling that the party will become more narrow. One person you didn't see mentioned Chukwuemeka and Angela, and say Chukwuemeka's probably been historically sort of a very a progress MP, but also before that he was a Compass MP, so he was a Brownite MP. Now, as someone from sort of the new generation of this, I don't necessarily think the labels Blairite and Brownite are helpful anymore. But I do see a more sort of progressive wing of the party that I put myself on, and then a more like state socialist wing of the party, which I'd put a lot of the Corbyn left on. But I do think that there are sort of lots of younger people on the Corbyn left who actually, I think, in a very similar way too, and the difference isn't necessarily too much one of policy, but more one of personnel and culture. And I think those problems are difficult to overcome, but they can be overcome. I completely agree with you that I think being driven by a set group of people who believe in state, let me just go back and try and rephrase that. But I think there is a project that is being driven by a group of people towards a kind of state socialism that actually is quite far from the way lots of the membership, even further on the left of the party, really want to see. And a lot of that is alienating MPs. I actually think lots of MPs, like myself, have a very strong attachment to the Labour Party. Believe it in it as a party of working people, believe that it is the best force for progressive change this country has ever seen, and actually leaving is such a huge step. I mean, one of the MPs you didn't mention was Lusana Berger. And I was at Labour Party conference last year, and I was there, and she came to a few of our events, and she had to have a police escort. She had to have the police drop her off and pick her up and watch her and make sure that she was okay because of the abuse she received. And one, that was just horrible. It's horrible to be, as an MP at your own party's conference, to feel this uncomfortable. But also, two, what was interesting was the reaction on social media afterwards, where sort of the left wing, the hard left wing sort of troll army came out and said she didn't have police protection. Here's all the reason why, and sort of made freedom of information requests and said, oh, you know, they weren't really armed. There's like, there wasn't real police, having someone walking with her isn't the same. And I just said, well, I was there. There were two police officers with her all the time. And that testimony wasn't enough to convince them that that was true. And I think it's that sort of, some people in the Labour Party call it the crank left. And it's the infiltration of the crank left who abuse MPs and abuse people, and particularly abuse Jewish members, that I think are the real problem. And it has to be, basically, I think the integrity of the Labour Party depends on tackling that.
Now, one of the things that we've mentioned and we've talked quite a bit throughout the podcast has been not only polarisation, but again, as you mentioned, abuse felt by MPs and members in different parties across the political spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you think we can go about ensuring that politics does not devolve into sort of much more abuse and becomes far more abusive than it is already, and perhaps turn it more in a direction of cooperation and less tribalism?
I mean, that's a really, really hard question. I think we're stuck in a problem of our own making. I don't know if you two agree, but it feels like British politics is based on a tribal adversarial system. Like the way the House of Commons is set up for tribalism and for adversarial arguments. I don't necessarily think there's an inherent problem with that, but I think there's a problem with that when norms of discussion, conversation and politics are eroded. And I think we've seen that. I think we've seen that through Twitter. I really actually don't like Twitter as a format at all. One of the few politics people to not like it. Not to like it, rather. Because I don't think you can have a proper discussion or a proper conversation with someone who doesn't agree with you about a point of politics. I just don't think it's possible to do it in that many characters. It's there for the hot take, but it's not there for any kind of detailed discussion or disagreement, which I think means that people can often speak to each other in bad faith. People are hidden very often behind their screens, which makes it very difficult to, you know, it's much harder to have a conversation, have an argument with someone who's standing in front of you in the flesh than it is over any kind of online platform. I think more than that, it's the lack of avenues, and this is something I really, really care about and I tried to do some work on, is a lack of avenues for ordinary people to get involved in politics. And by that, I don't mean like becoming members of a party or signing a petition, but I mean really understanding how the system works. Like, I don't think political education in this country is good. I think it's very, very, very bad. And if you put my sort of conspiracy theorist hat on, I kind of think that sort of a reason behind that, that people actually found it easier not to give people the information they needed to do things. But I think actually what we're reaping now is the consequence of not educating people about how they take action in their communities and how they take action through politics. I think it's really interesting that politics is sort of the way I see politics. I'm sure someone before me wrote this and I've just absorbed it, is, you know, the way we arbitrate between the disagreements that we have, right? And if not everyone has access to that method of arbitration, then we're going to have a problem. And that's what we're seeing now. And no, I don't have an answer to it, basically. I think we're really messed up and we should educate people that that's going to be a generational change as opposed to an immediate change.
Going back to sort of polarisation within the Labour Party, there's a NEC motion that's sort of got a bit of traction on Twitter. You say you don't really like Twitter, but about getting rid of Labour students, and it's sort of been seen as Labour students have been associated with the progress sort of more on the sort of Blairite wing of the party, in the youth party. What's your view on this? Do you think that the Labour students does need to change, or do you think that this is just petty from sort of John Lansman?
I think you can think both things are true. I think it's, you know, incredibly petty from John Lansman, you know, just before a general election to say, actually, we want to get rid of the organisation that organises students around the country because it's in sort of the political control of a group that he doesn't agree with. I don't think that's the right, and I think it comes back to sort of what I mean by the tone and the culture of the Labour Party at the moment, in that I don't think that's necessarily helpful. Like, you know, Labour students do great work. They organise students around the country. They contact Labour clubs. They move motions in US. They do a lot of work on the doorstep. They really are the tireless activists in university towns come from Labour students. Do I think that I would like to see more pluralism in Labour students? Yes. Probably. But also, I think more than that, it's thinking about actually how to get involved to the Labour Party sort of outside that. So I was never in Labour Students, which is sort of weird for everyone I meet. It's actually saying, well, if you're a student, you're involved in the Labour Party, how to make sure Labour clubs and Labour students is as open as possible, and actually how to make sure that all those roots in. So, you know, I'm a member of Young Labour, but I go to Young Labour and I feel like my views aren't listened to very clearly. And that, you know, my political opinion isn't respected. And I think we need to come to a point, coming back to what we said about the conversation about the polarization, where within all these organizations, we can have the discussion in a very frank and open and honest and actually good faith way. And I don't think that John Lansman's operating in good faith here. I think he's trying to score cheap points, and actually now in the middle of a Brexit crisis and heading to a general election, I don't think now's the time to be doing that.
So you mentioned sort of Young Labour. What's the age cutoff for that, out of interest? Because I'm in the Young Conservatives, and I know that goes up to 25, but there's been a lot of debate about sort of what counts as a young person, you know, like what's got in common what, because, you know, like obviously a 14-year-old and a 30-year-old professional haven't really got that much in common.
So I don't quote me on this. I think Young Labour's 27. And then I think if you, which is like a little bit older than Young Conservatives, because I think quite interesting is the Young Fabians goes up to, so the Fabian Society and the Affiliated Society of the Labour Party, they do lots of policy work and a bit involved with them as well, and they go up to 31, which is significantly older than lots of other groups. I do think, sort of, like, I'm 25 now, that maybe, yes, I still feel like I have a couple of years left to go as a young person. I'm doing air quotes here, but obviously you can't see them. Mainly because I think, you know, the way we work and the way we live has changed so much. I feel, you know, younger, I'm insecure, I'm renting, I'm going to start my career. Whereas I think maybe, you know, 10 or even 5 years ago, someone who was my age would probably have been more likely to be, you know, in their own home or sort of a little bit further on in their sort of life path or whatever you'd like to call it. So I feel like it makes more sense, because I feel that even though maybe a 14-year-old and 30-year-old don't have lots in common in terms of what they're experiencing in life, actually the same issues such as intergenerational fairness, changes to the world of work, general insecurity about what comes next, pensions, climate, all those issues are actually very common to all young people, and that group is growing.
You mentioned that as a student you weren't involved with Labour Students, but an organisation that you are involved with is Students Supporting Street Kids, which is a great charity. Could you explain to our listeners what work you do there?
Sure. I'm a trustee of Students Supporting Street Kids, and what we do is, it started by two students who, you know, went travelling, went my gap year, but this was years ago, sort of 20 years ago, and came back and said they'd been to countries, you know, around the world, and I think the original ones, one of them is in Vietnam, and I was in the Philippines, and there are a couple of in Latin America as well, the original charities, and they're local projects supporting street connected children. And sort of street connected children isn't necessarily children who are homeless on the street, but they might be very poor children who work on the street, have family working on the street, and basically live much of their lives involved with the street. And then obviously there are a number of issues that go along with that, right? So chance of exploitation, whether that's their labor being exploited, sexual exploitation, problems with drugs, and often being abused by the police and other authorities. And basically Students Supporting Street Kids was set up to provide a mechanism, so we've got no overheads because we're all volunteer trustees, to enable students to raise money for young people around the world who were street and are street connected to do things. So it may be that it might be attend school, it might be, you know, creating a home for some of these young people. It might be really simple things like food and shelter. And I think I've been involved with them for a little while now, and I think it's quite an interesting model in terms of the fact that we have personal relationships with all the organisations we work with. And we go and visit those organisations, and actually the students, so we have branches at a number of universities. We've four universities. So we've got one, the London University is one big branch, Edinburgh, and then Oxford and Cambridge at the moment. And the students raise money for other students who in lots of ways are like them. And they can see the impact, and they can often go in, actually, what I think is one of the most important things, they can go and see, if they choose, they can see the work of one of our partner organisations. Knowing that we have a personal relationship with them, knowing that the money is being well spent, and actually see where the money is being spent, and do something helpful with the knowledge of the issues involved without falling into that trap of voluntourism, mm-hmm. where you sort of turn up. I mean, we've heard some awful stories that we've worked with some organisations in Southeast Asia, and some of them actually have stopped being, I think it was Cambodia, have stopped being residential or accepting new residential students in, because there was such a problem with young people, mainly from Australia, travelling to volunteer in orphanages.
Mm.
So they were finding children to put in orphanages so people could come and volunteer in them. And that kind of practice is inherently exploitative. So it's trying to support organisations without falling into that trap of exploitation, which I think is really important.
Well, thank you for joining us anyway today. We're coming up to the end of the podcast. Now, just before we go, Boris Johnson recently hit the headlines for comparing himself to the Incredible Hulk. Now, what have you got a favourite superhero? Which superhero would you compare yourself to?
Which superhero would I compare myself to? Oh, I don't think I could do that. I'm a bit weird, and I quite like Doctor Strange.
Mm.
Just because I think he's really cool and can do cool things with time. Also, I really like the coat. I know that's not
a
very
nice coat.
it's a very nice coat. And I think it makes him look very suave. And I kind of like the idea that he's able to control time with his mind, because I could always use more of it.
Yeah, well, I think that applies for everyone. That's the one thing that probably could end political polarisation. That everyone's agreeing on, is that we all want a bit more time.
Yeah. Extend Brexit to 30 years rather than 3. Why not?
I don't think people would be too keen on that one. So, thank you for joining us. If people want to sort of find out a bit more about you, what can they do?
Well, my Twitter handle is at HeatherShell94. And as you both so kindly mentioned, we present a weekly podcast at Progress. It's called the Progressive Britain Podcast, where we interview Labour MPs and activists doing great campaigning work around the country. And I recommend you have a listen.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to this podcast. If you want to sort of get in contact, you can email us at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, I think, as well now.
Mm-hmm.
You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, or I think we're on YouTube as well. So
yeah, we're on YouTube as well.
Yeah, so all the places that you can get podcasts, basically. So thank you everyone for listening, and you'll hear us in the next episode.